Hello, everyone. I'm Clay Jenkinson, the creator of the Thomas Jefferson Hour. This week, you're hearing not a conversation between David Swensen and the third president of the United States, but the beginning of what we hope will be an exciting new enterprise for the Thomas Jefferson Hour. You're going to hear the first chapter of my book, Becoming Jefferson's People, with commentary here and there, and you'll be hearing more chapters in the weeks ahead. But stay tuned. We'll be back with traditional Thomas Jefferson Q&A programs coming soon. Hello, my name is Clay Jenkinson. I'm the author of Becoming Jefferson's People, Reinventing the American Republic in the 21st Century, a book published by Marmoth Press in North Dakota in 2005. What I intend to do is to read this book and comment on it, so this is a kind of audio book plus commentary and even lecture. There will be plenty of digressions in which I step back to talk about what I meant when I penned certain words or how things possibly have changed between the time that I wrote this book and now the reading of it 2 years later. What I have in mind is to create an audio book of Becoming Jefferson's People, Reinventing the American Republic in the 21st Century, but to add a fair amount of commentary about Thomas Jefferson, about where the United States is in the early 21st century, and what I think the Jeffersonian renewal might be. So hang on, here we go. There will be lots of digressions. I'll try to cue you in when I leave the text and when I come back to it. But if you want to read the book in its more contained and restrained form, you simply need to buy a copy of Becoming Jefferson's People, Reinventing the American Republic in the 21st Century. So welcome aboard. You know, let me just start by reflecting for a minute, and this we'll just get our sound check and everything, but you know, last night, I thought about this country. I was reading the novel Bleak House by Charles Dickens, How to Use This Book. I wrote this slender book to encourage a national conversation about the future of America. You know, it couldn't get any simpler than that. I wrote this slender book to encourage a national conversation about the future of America. Like hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of others, I deplore the shallowness, corruption, and frivolousness of our national politics, the puniness of our national attention span, and the inanity of what passes for popular culture in the United States at the beginning of the 21st century. It squares not at all with what I learned in civics classes in my youth, nor with the idealism that I felt and was made to feel as a child growing up in America in the 1960s and 70s. For all of their childish partisanship, our two national political parties are virtually identical in essential respects. They are, in my view, both Hamiltonian. For all of their childish partisanship, our two national political parties are virtually identical in essential respects. They are, in my view, both Hamiltonian parties, the Greater Hamiltonian Party and the Lesser Hamiltonian Party. Nor is it clear that our official constitutional culture really governs the United States. From a Jeffersonian point of view, we are in the midst of a fundamental national crisis, and yet we seem not to be talking about it in any meaningful way. The sorry state we have descended into has produced widespread cynicism and apathy. It is almost impossible to convince anyone that the people of the United States still govern themselves in any meaningful sense, or that our representatives want to do the right thing, or that their actions would make a difference even if they were committed to the Commonwealth. There is a very widespread belief that things are bad and that they are going to get worse, not better. Surely a once great republic deserves better than this. I was trained in the public humanities arena as represented by the National Endowment for the Humanities and its state affiliates, partners, they now like to be called, as represented by National Public Radio and Public Television. My great mentor Everett C. Elbers of the North Dakota Humanities Council taught me that it is a mistake to conclude that the American people are as shallow and disengaged as they might appear to be. Everett believed, and after addressing public audiences thousands of times, I agree, that the American people are intelligent, sensible, concerned about their world, and hungry for intelligent discourse, and that they would respond favorably to more humanities discussions if they were offered them in attractive ways. If this is true, that beneath the surface cynicism there is substantial and widespread willingness to engage in a national conversation about the future, then it is of some urgency that we find vehicles and forums for that conversation. This book invites us to dream again about a Jeffersonian republic. In calling for a national conversation, I have in mind a range of activities, not all of which require the entire population to be engaged at the same time. If everyone who reads this book will initiate discussions of America's identity and place in the world at the workplace water cooler, for example, with his or her spouse and family, among close friends while waiting in line at the restaurant or the movie, in email with one's faraway friends, on the bus, while walking the dog, or while taking a postprandial walk, the dialogue might spread until it embraced a substantial percentage of the American public. I also urge you to host dinner parties for your friends and colleagues, and during them, to initiate thoughtful conversations which resemble the salon culture that Jefferson found so satisfying during his Paris years, 1784 to 89. Raise these questions in church, with your book club, in classrooms, and during sojourns in nature. Put these questions to the politicians who venture into your midst and ask for your support. Write letters to the editor. Post your thoughts on the internet. It may be that at some point these local conversations will coalesce into a coordinated national conversation. That would be useful, but it would present severe challenges to the integrity of those conversations. The future of the free world cannot be settled in sound bites between commercials for diet soda and cars and Girls Gone Wild videos. But national media attention, however inadequate, might inspire more individuals and groups to undertake the right kind of conversation in Jeffersonian pockets throughout the country. In other words, the conversation can be national without having to be conducted on Larry King Live. In a sense, such a discussion would amount to the generational constitutional convention that Jefferson advocated. Jefferson argued that no single generation should fail to reinvent America, to raise the fundamental questions of civilization, and to create its own civic arrangements. Jefferson believed that a nation that governs itself according to ancient and venerable constitutions was almost certainly hidebound and at odds with the actual dynamics of civilization. As the 21st century begins, we need to ask ourselves who we are, what we stand for, what we care about, how we would like to be perceived by our friends and enemies, what role we should play in the world, and how we would like to organize our public spaces. I just want to stop to repeat that. You know, Jefferson's view was that we need to tear up the Constitution of the United States once every generation and start fresh, and that the reason to do that is to update our basic legal instruments, our legal documents, our social code, to the actual technologies and demographics and social circumstances, the problems and opportunities of any given moment, that we need to constantly be recreating ourselves so that our constitutions address the world that is, not the world that ought to be, and that our basic instruments have constitutional teeth to get at the problems that people actually have to face in the world. And that it was Jefferson's view that by clinging to our Madisonian Constitution, the one written in 1787, and regarding it in a sense as a sacred document, that we are making it impossible for us to remain dynamic in the world. And by doing so, by clinging to this document that was written in a 3-mile-per-hour world, in a world that didn't know cloning, a world that didn't know the internet, a world that didn't know the automobile, a world that had never seen an airplane, a world that didn't know anything about antibiotics or penicillin or a heart transplant, that for us to try to govern ourselves in modern times using essentially an ancient and venerable document like the Constitution of the United States inevitably put strain on that document. It meant that we had to stretch it to cover things that it couldn't have been designed to cover. And we have to pull, tug it so that it can embrace things that were unthinkable to James Madison and Gouverneur Morris and Alexander Hamilton and Benjamin Franklin. And that in doing so, in straining it in this way, we inevitably produce distortions. We inevitably create conditions of corruption and governmental abuse, and to sort of respond to one of the great bugbears of our time, by stretching this vague 18th century constitution to cover 21st century technologies and events, we inevitably make the judicial system central. In other words, if you don't have a constitution that gets updated to face the world as it actually is, and instead you want to use an ancient one and somehow find clauses in it that can be made to govern conditions that didn't exist at the time of its writing, then that puts enormous pressure on judges to interpret that instrument. And that's where we get the sort of the mantra of the conservatives legislating from the bench, judicial activism, judicial legislation, overactive judges, judges who are intruding into the democratic process. The reason they intrude is because we force them to, because we've given them a constitution that can't understand biotechnological engineering or late-term abortion or cyber porn. And then we are expecting them to use that vague Newtonian document to adjust those very public policy questions. This inevitably makes the judges say, well, we're going to take that clause, the general welfare clause, and maybe it can be seen to reflect on cloning. We'll take the First Amendment, and maybe it can be seen to cover cyber pornography or cyber predation of our children. And so by not giving them a better thing to work with, a better text to work with, we're forcing them to be judicial activists. And then when judges do become judicial activists, we condemn them for doing what we never had intended when we created the nation. It's wrong. That's where the strain comes in. And if Jefferson stands for anything, he stands for the idea that a great and dynamic people steps back from time to time to look at its basic laws and institutions and asks, how well are they doing? Are they still relevant? What kind of amendments and adjustments are needed? Should we start over? And so the point I'm trying to make in this early paragraph of this book is that Jefferson is someone who wants the nation to stay current, and he wants us as a nation to ask hard questions. He likes dissent. And so I pick it up again on page 4. As the 21st century begins, we need to ask ourselves who we are, what we stand for, what we care about, how we would like to be perceived by our friends and our enemies, what role we should play in the world, and how we would like to organize our public spaces. Those are the Jeffersonian questions. And it's shocking, as the 21st century begins, to see how little the mass of Americans attend to those questions. If we are a Jeffersonian nation, we are self-conscious about these questions. And if we're not, then in some sense the people are no longer engaged. And that would be, for Jefferson, just a horrible disappointment. So I return to the book. Ideally, the result of such a national conversation would be that a new political party, or at least a new political persuasion, would rise spontaneously from the sovereign, that is, the American people, and it would displace the sordid enterprise that passes for our national political culture. Because there is no true alternative to the center-right way things operate under our two-party system, countless Americans have become disaffected, disillusioned, and I think literally diseased. I'm playing here on the pun between diseased and the medical term diseased. And I do think, without pushing this too far, that when you become disaffected, disillusioned, and diseased, that you open the door in the human immune system to disease, and that our healthcare crisis is because we have become abstracted from our bodies, and because we have become extracted from the body politic, and that if we reintegrated our souls into our bodies and our individuality into the collective body, the body politic, that we would be a healthier people in every possible respect. And so just to repeat that sentence, because there is no true alternative to the center-right way things operate under our two-party system, countless Americans have become disaffected, disillusioned, and I think literally diseased. The people need a new vehicle for their idealism and a new voice for their concerns about their beloved country. Now to the disclaimers. In writing this book, I have no delusions of grandeur or fantasy that it will have profound influence. And at the time of my reading this book and commenting on it, it has sold about 10,000 copies. So that's great for me. It's been a great success as a book for me. But 10,000 copies in a nation of 300 million, if you sell 10,000 copies, what percentage are actually read, and so on. You know, I don't have any sense that my own work is going to be very important. I hope that I feel exactly like Thomas Jefferson. He always played down his own agency in whatever he did, and always said that if this works, if this is important, if this changes the world, it's not because of me, it's because of the ideas that it contains. In other words, it's not about the author, it's about the author's capacity to articulate things that exist in a broader community. So the reason why the Bill of Rights is so important is that it's a text, and people who didn't want a Bill of Rights said, why would you want to write these things down? But Jefferson said, no, if you have a text, if you have the First Amendment, people can point to it and say, I have the right to assemble. If you have the Second Amendment, it's a text, it's written down, it's codified. People can point to it and say, I'm guaranteed the right to keep and bear arms. If you have the Tenth Amendment as a text, people can say, those powers that are not delegated to the national government belong instead to the states and to the people. In other words, Jefferson's idea was that a text matters because a text is something you can share. It's something you can export, you can point to. And by having these texts that articulate things that may be commonplace but nevertheless need to be put down on paper, the text can be a rallying cry for something beyond conversation. And that's precisely what I feel. I don't feel important in this conversation at all, but I feel that because of my 20 or so years working on Thomas Jefferson and my deep love of the Jeffersonian ideals for this country, that I'm in a position to articulate the Jeffersonian. And by doing so, I may be creating a textual platform at which people can gather and further this conversation. And it may be that people who never have heard of me and never have heard of this book, in some sense, will become more Jeffersonian because of some rippling effect that may occur thanks to the few thousand people who actually will have purchased and read it. So I'm a Jeffersonian. I believe that the good news travels fast and that it doesn't have to travel by way of book sales, that it can travel in any number of ways, and that the goal is not to fix the world, because that would be hubristic and unrealistic. The goal is to do whatever you can to try to articulate how the world would look if it were fixed, to be humble about that, because I don't really know enough to know what it needs, but to make the case for the world that you want to live in as clearly as you can. And then in a free marketplace of ideas, if that argument has validity, it will travel. And if that argument doesn't have validity, it will die on the vine. And that's exactly how the Enlightenment wanted it to be. So I feel very optimistic about the ideas that I'm calling Jeffersonian ideas that are articulated in this book. But I feel very humble about my own role in it. And in some sense, all I'm doing is serving as a kind of distilling apparatus for what I take to be the central codes of the Jeffersonian vision of America. So, to return, in writing this book, I have no delusions of grandeur or fantasy that it will have profound influence. That's to put it lightly. But I do believe that the first steps towards national renewal must take place soon, or we will be beyond redemption. In other words, I think this is a pivotal moment in American history, and I think, frankly, we're losing the battle. And even if such conversations do not change the course of human events, they certainly will change individual lives. And I already know this because I have a number of people have written to me saying, I've read this book, I've taken some of it to heart, it's changed some of the patterns of my behavior. It's actually improved my marriage or improved my friendship or improved my community. And so I know that the Jeffersonian ideals are inspiring and transformative. And so even if this book can't possibly change America, which would be kind of a silly notion for one individual to ever believe, if they change some lives or give people confidence that they're on the right track, then this book will have been worth it. This book is designed to inspire my fellow citizens to become Jeffersonians and to help create a new Jeffersonianism in America. It is my conviction that everyone who leads a more Jeffersonian life will be more fulfilled, happier, more productive, and more influential. I also believe that people who become Jeffersonians because they wish to live well turn out as if by magic to be the natural leaders in all the walks of their lives. And that's something that I really spent a lot of time thinking about. In other words, one of the great Supreme Court justices said once, "My life is my argument," by which he meant, it's the way I'm living that is my message to the world. If I'm living well, then the world will see that and admire it and want to emulate it. That's more important than anything I could write in a pamphlet or treatise. And so what I've discovered is that people who are Jeffersonians, who are creative, who turn off their television, who are engaged with the earth, who try to use science and good sense, who are civil, who are optimists and equalitarians, that these people, and you see them all over, and they're always beautiful people leading lives of integrity and beauty and even elegance, that becomes the basis for leadership, that other people see that and think, I'm going to listen to her because look at the way she lives. You know, look what she's accomplished. Look at the healthy spirit that she carries around with her. And so I believe that even though many Jeffersonians and Jefferson himself were reluctant leaders, being a Jeffersonian is almost a magical talisman to create leadership by way of example and sometimes by way of oratory and overt leadership of one sort or another. I also believe that people who become Jeffersonians because they wish to live well turn out, as if by magic, to be the natural leaders in all the walks of their lives. We seek the Jeffersonian persuasion in our private pursuit of happiness, but it turns out to have important and wholly positive social ramifications. I have attempted here to explore what a Jeffersonian outlook might be at the beginning of the 21st century. So to summarize that portion of my preface, I have attempted here to explore what a Jeffersonian outlook might be at the beginning of the 21st century. Now to Jefferson for a moment. Those who are looking for a balanced assessment of Jefferson's strengths and weaknesses will not find it here. I have written about these questions elsewhere. This book emphasizes Jefferson's idealism, his republicanism, his commitment to reason and good sense, and his life as a Renaissance man and an exemplar of the Enlightenment. In other words, this book emphasizes Jefferson's positive vision for the American Republic. I do not wish to be perceived as somehow in denial about the dark side of Jefferson's life and character. I am fully aware that Jefferson was a slaveholder, a racist, an apartheidist, a perpetuator of slavery into the American West, and probably the father of several of Sally Hemings' children. I know that Jefferson advocated Indian removal policies that barely distinguish him from his successor, Andrew Jackson, and that there were times, admittedly few, when he fantasized about the extinction of at least some portion of Indian America. I realize that Jefferson had a patronizing attitude toward women in public life, and that his preference for women who exhibited, quote, that softness of disposition which is the ornament of her sex and the charm of ours, has a grating effect on enlightened men and women of our time. I know that some historians regard Jefferson's intensely selfish relationships with his two adult daughters as psychologically claustrophobic and arguably worse. I was with a famous feminist historian at a dinner at the White House in 1993, and she reached across the table to talk to me, and she said, "What do you say about the fact that Jefferson committed psychological incest with his daughters?" And I was shocked, and I said, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "Jefferson's controlling, claustrophobic relationship with his daughters Maria and Martha, although it didn't involve sexual abuse, was abusive in a metaphoric sense because he was effectively intruding himself into their own sovereignty as young women and attempting to control their set of responses to the men around them, to family, to their famous father, to their famous father's secrets, and so on, and that by loving them with this kind of obsessive, compulsive need to shape and control their lives, Jefferson was making it impossible for them to experiment with their adult souls and become independent beings, that he was in a sense doing a Pygmalion coercion shaping of these young women, and that in doing so he hampered their capacity to find happiness and to determine their own identities, and in doing so, it was a corruption. It was, and she called this psychological incest. Well, I don't really go that far. I think, for example, that Jefferson's relationship with his older daughter, Martha, was maybe the most successful relationship of his entire life, and that he and Martha had an extraordinary good understanding of each other, and we don't know enough about her because she didn't leave documents in quite the same way that Jefferson did. But I'm just guessing that she had a complex and, to a certain degree, ironic attitude towards her famous father, and that she was all too well aware of his strengths and weaknesses, and that she worked around them and did so in a kind of polite 18th century Jane Austen sort of way. But no part of me thinks that she was incapable of seeing through that which was unhealthy or unresolved in her father's soul. And so to make her a victim, to sort of suggest that she never got a chance in life because her father was psychologically oppressive or incestuous, I think is simply wrong, and it's tendentious and politically motivated and designed more to shock and make a point than it is to really get at the truth of this relationship. But nevertheless, it certainly is the case that Jefferson micromanaged his daughter's education in a way that would no longer be seen as entirely healthy, and he, in a sense, supervised their mating habits in a way that would no longer be permitted by one's daughters. But for all of that, I think we have to be a little bit careful when we talk about psychological incest or psychological damage. That's presentism, using our sense of what a good relationship is and projecting it back to a world 200 years ago. And it's also presuming a lot, because we know Jefferson, thanks to the prolific nature of his writings, but we don't know Maria and Martha very well. And I think for us to make inferences based upon a very light evidence pool about something so private and indeed sacred as a father-daughter relationship is dangerous. But let me go back and pick this up. I know that some historians regard Jefferson's intensely selfish relationships with his two adult daughters as psychologically claustrophobic and arguably worse. I know that Jefferson was a profligate spender who died helplessly in debt. I know, too, that Jefferson had a Machiavellian streak that led him to fight unscrupulously to defeat his enemies in the Federalist Party between 1790 and 1800, and that this included paying James Callender to write ugly nonsense about the Adams administration. I know that Jefferson can be shown to have at one time or another advocated prosecution of opposition newspapers, censorship, and erosion of the Fourth Amendment, that he prejudiced the Aaron Burr treason trial, and that he wrote a bill of attainder while serving as the wartime governor of Virginia. There is more, and it is not admirable. Now, I don't know if that's a pretty stark and unkind paragraph about Thomas Jefferson. I'm going to read it again in its entirety so that you can feel the accumulative effect of this indictment. But what I'm saying here is I know that there is a Jefferson problem, that Jefferson is no longer a kind of plaster saint that we can look up to as this entirely benevolent and serene, rational founding father. I know that there's a Jefferson problem, and you can say hypocrite, inconsistent, complex, man of his times. You can say what you please, but there is, but some portions, I think this paragraph nicely sums up the attack on Jefferson as the 21st century begins, and I'm aware that some of these, even if they're overstated, even if they're thrown up for political effect, or that in a sense it's more about the critic than it is about the man criticized. I know that some germ of truth is here, and that this amounts to a fairly considerable indictment of somebody who used to be regarded as one of America's principal heroes. This is from page 6. I do not wish to be perceived as somehow in denial about the dark side of Jefferson's life and character. I'm fully aware that Jefferson was a slaveholder, a racist, an apartheidist, a perpetuator of slavery into the American West, and, probably, the father of several of Sally Hemings' children. I know that Jefferson advocated Indian removal policies that barely distinguish him from his successor, Andrew Jackson, and that there were times, admittedly few, when he fantasized about the extinction of at least some portions of Indian America. I realized that Jefferson had a patronizing attitude toward women in public life, and that his preference for women who exhibited, quote, that softness of disposition which is the ornament of her sex and charm of ours, has a grating effect on enlightened men and women of our time. I know that some historians regard Jefferson's intensely selfish relationships with his two adult daughters as psychologically claustrophobic and arguably worse. I know that Jefferson was a profligate spender who died helplessly in debt. I know, too, that Jefferson had a Machiavellian streak that led him to fight unscrupulously to defeat his enemies in the Federalist Party between 1790 and 1800, and that this included paying James Callender to write ugly nonsense about the Adams administration. I know that Jefferson can be shown to have, at one time or another, advocated prosecution of opposition newspapers, censorship, and erosion of the Fourth Amendment, and that he prejudiced the Aaron Burr treason trial, and that he wrote a bill of attainder while serving as the wartime governor of Virginia. There is more, and it is not admirable. Why, that's, in a sense, the hardest paragraph I ever had to write about my hero Thomas Jefferson, because... And it's indebted, by the way, to Leonard Levy's Jefferson and Civil Liberties, The Darker Side, which was a pioneering book in the 1970s about the gap between Jefferson's idealism and his actual behavior. And some of this is indebted to the Lewis and Clark Expedition, which really fleshed out Jefferson's Indian policies in some interesting and new ways. And a lot of this has to do with our increasing concern about Jefferson and slavery. You know, Jefferson has effectively, in the 21st century, become the poster child for the unresolved race tensions in American life. Even though 9 of the first 12 presidents owned slaves, and George Washington owned slaves, and James Madison owned slaves, and James Monroe owned slaves, and Patrick Henry owned slaves, and so on and so forth. Of all the founding fathers, the one that we associate with the paradox of slavery or the hypocrisy of advocating freedom and owning slaves, that person is none other than Jefferson. And so this indictment of Jefferson, which pains me to articulate, I think is a necessary preface to the book so that critics don't say, well, how can I believe Jefferson's strictures about education when he was a contemptible hypocrite. The easiest way not to come to terms with Jefferson's dream for America is to discredit the dreamer, and that has become a kind of cottage industry at the end of the 20th and the beginning of the 21st centuries, and I didn't want to get stuck there. So I wanted to stipulate, to use a legal term, to stipulate, to grant that there's a great deal that could be said critical of the man Thomas Jefferson, so that people who are disposed to want to cling to that, and believe me, there are many, will get their fill of it right at the beginning and realize that I'm not an apologist for Thomas Jefferson. I love Jefferson, but I'm not his apologist. What I'm doing here is not deciding who Jefferson was. I'm trying to discern what Jefferson envisioned, which is a very, very different enterprise. But to go on, page 7. By now it is clear to everyone that the man Thomas Jefferson was not always equal to the ideals he so beautifully espoused. We are witnessing the ex post facto tragedy of Thomas Jefferson, if by tragedy we mean that a great individual is destroyed not by impersonal forces of destiny, but by unresolved energies in his own character. In other words, the classical definition of tragedy is that the tragic protagonist, Oedipus or Hamlet or King Lear, contains within his own character, his own way of seeing the world, the seeds of his destruction. Hamlet speaks of the vicious mole of nature that is in us, but the idea of tragedy is that it's not getting hit by a cruise missile or being struck by cancer just at the moment that your life, that you won the Nobel Peace Prize or something. That's not tragedy. That's bad, but it's not tragedy. Tragedy is that we contain within ourselves the seeds of our own destruction, that there's something about our character set that leads us to go off the precipice, and that it's something inherent in us which is the source of our tragedy. There may be external calamities that are part of it, but it's something contained within the tragic character. And so what I'm saying here is that in a sense, even though Jefferson is America's Pollyanna and our greatest optimist and a dreamer and an almost entirely cheerful visionary, there's a kind of tragedy in seeing now that Jefferson's historical reputation is being dissolved, and dissolved not by external forces, but by unresolved energies and tensions within his own character. So let me just repeat that. We are witnessing the ex post facto tragedy of Thomas Jefferson, if by tragedy we mean that a great individual is destroyed not by impersonal forces of destiny, but by unresolved energies in his own character. The fall of Thomas Jefferson poses a twofold danger to our republic. First, some now refuse to listen to Jefferson because they cannot stomach what they perceive to be his inconsistencies, or, as extremists put it, his contemptible hypocrisies. They have stopped listening to Jefferson's Enlightenment pronouncements because they cannot help but deconstruct them in light of Jefferson's sometimes deplorable actual behavior in the world. Second, and much worse, some believe that the ideals that Jefferson espoused are inherently problematic, even meaningless, and that Jefferson's profound inconsistencies signify not just the measure of his personal failures, but the essential hollowness of his ideals, or for that matter, any Enlightenment ideals. And what I mean by that is that this really goes to the current cultural studies movement in postmodernism. And postmodernism argues that there is no truth, no beauty, no justice, that we only have truthiness and beautiness, that cultures give privilege. They privilege certain things and call them beautiful. They're not intrinsically beautiful. They're beautiful because the established power centers have decided that they're beautiful. And so the literary canon isn't a canon of merit, according to the deconstructionists and postmodernists. It's an artificial canon of white male privileged authors that has been maintained not because it's inherently good or beautiful, but because it's part of the power game of culture, and that there's no justice. There really is only power adjustments, and we call it justice to cheer ourselves up. And this comes really as an assault on the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment has been recently seen as this sort of shallow, vapid period in the history of civilization when people like Jefferson and Franklin and Voltaire thought that all human problems could be solved through good sense and reason, and they put forward these ideals of truth and justice and enlightenment and equality and so on, but it was all really just shallow talk, and it had very little to do with the actual way the world was unfolding, and the talk was so glib and superficially attractive that it sort of put us to sleep about the actual way the world worked. The world worked behind the scenes more or less as the world has always worked, and this was just kind of a cultural charade of cheering ourselves up in the face of the world as it, in its messy and unresolved form, has always existed and always will. And so the point I'm making here is that there are two problems with discrediting Jefferson. One is that, to put it in a kind of the stupid cliche, we throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, so by discrediting Jefferson on Sally Hemings or slavery or Indians, then we cease to take him seriously on the broader front, where we still, I think, need to take him seriously. That's the problem number one. Problem number two is that this just the dethroning of Jefferson, or the erasing of Jefferson from Mount Rushmore in the minds of the public, is just another attack on the Enlightenment, it turns out. And instead of saying Jefferson was a great exemplar of the Enlightenment, who also was in many respects an imperfect man, which is what I think the truth is, we instead say, because Jefferson was so hypocritical, effectively he's just exposing the hollowness of the Enlightenment, which we sort of had reckoned on anyway. So now we won't take any of that very seriously, because look, the Enlightenment's greatest exemplar turns out to be this contemptible fellow. So I do think that, to put it in slightly different terms, we're living in a disillusioned time. We're living in a cynical time. My own view is that we're very disillusioned with ourselves, because we're living lives that are based on lies. Certainly we're living unsustainable lives. And because of that, it's in our interest to go back and take our idealists and re-examine them to prove that they weren't any better than we are. And so the dreams that they espoused are not worth pursuing because they're imperfect, we're imperfect, those dreams are imperfect. Maybe the world just is the hopeless thing that it seems to be, and we have no duties to try to rise to a higher state of good sense or enlightenment. So I think the cynicism and disillusion of our time have given us a kind of motive to deconstruct Thomas Jefferson and others and find that they are much less admirable than the mythology suggests. In other words, in assaulting them, in some ironic sense, we're cheering ourselves up. I think that there's a very great deal of this going on in our time, and I think that it is ruinous to the idea of America. So I summarize all of that. This seems to me to be the veriest nonsense. The Enlightenment's ideals, for all of their seeming superficiality, have revolutionized the world and bettered life on earth in undeniable and measurable ways. No people who enjoys the fruits of the Enlightenment, the rule of law, secular education, bills of rights, separation of church and state, the sanctity of contract, the apotheosis of science, a free press, free inquiry, would ever choose to go back to something more fundamentalist. I repeat, no people who enjoys the fruits of the Enlightenment, the rule of law, secular education, bills of rights, separation of church and state, the sanctity of contract, the apotheosis of science, free press, and free inquiry, would ever choose to go back to something more fundamentalist. It's a very Jeffersonian point. When you have tasted the Enlightenment, you can never live with less. Jefferson was closer to the Enlightenment's ideals than most people of his time. Perhaps some of his friends and heroes were closer to those ideals than Jefferson. Those ideals matter, and when we are our best selves, and when America is its best self, those ideals inspire the entire world with their breathtaking clarity and dignity. If Jefferson is perceived to have failed, we are free to judge him and even dismiss him personally. But the ideals that he espoused will continue to be the standard of personal character, the pursuit of happiness, and the purposes of civilization forever. Jefferson knew this. His willingness to articulate the universal from within the messier world of actual life in 18th century Virginia or Philadelphia or Paris is in fact the foundation of his greatness. I believe that the United States needs a new infusion of what might be called clarified or updated Jeffersonianism. At the very least, we need a new generation of Jeffersonians. This book is my modest attempt to define and inspire that national conversation.
You've been listening to a special internet edition of the Thomas Jefferson Hour, with author Clay Jenkinson reading from his book, Becoming Jefferson's People. The audio version of this book will soon be available at our website, www.jeffersonhour.org. Thank you for listening.